In a world where love is diagnosed as a disease and cured through a mandatory procedure, Lauren Oliver's Requiem offers a haunting conclusion to her dystopian trilogy. The novel has captivated millions with its exploration of freedom, identity, and the human spirit's resilience against oppression. Since its 2013 release, Requiem has remained a cultural touchstone, with celebrities like Emma Watson praising its powerful message about the dangers of emotional suppression. As the finale to a series that sold over 3 million copies worldwide, it presents a society divided between those who believe emotions must be controlled and those fighting for the right to feel. The book's dual narrative structure, following both a rebel in the wilderness and a cured woman in civilization, creates a compelling examination of what it truly means to be free. The novel opens with protagonist Lena Halloway having escaped Portland, a walled city where citizens undergo a mandatory procedure to remove their capacity for love, and joined the resistance in the untamed area known as the Wilds. The stark contrast between these worlds forms the backbone of the narrative, with each territory representing opposing philosophies about human nature and society. Portland represents order, control, and emotional suppression, while the Wilds embody freedom, danger, and authentic feeling. This division serves as both a physical reality and a powerful metaphor for the choice between security and authentic human experience. Lena's journey through the Wilds with fellow resistors reveals the harsh reality of their freedom. They face daily struggles for survival, scavenging for food in abandoned buildings, sleeping in makeshift camps hidden from surveillance drones, and enduring bitter cold with limited supplies. Disease and injury pose constant threats, with medical care consisting of whatever supplies they can steal or salvage. Yet despite these hardships, there's a vibrancy to their existence that's absent in Portland. They share songs around campfires, form deep emotional bonds, and experience the full spectrum of human feelings, from passionate love to devastating grief. These connections sustain them through their hardships, proving that emotional authenticity provides its own kind of strength. Meanwhile, Portland's apparent safety comes at the devastating cost of emotional capacity. Citizens live in climate-controlled homes with reliable food supplies and modern conveniences, but exist in a state of emotional numbness that affects every aspect of their lives. Parents show no particular affection for their children, spouses interact with mechanical politeness, and friends maintain superficial relationships devoid of deep connection. The government controls every aspect of their lives through a complex system of regulations. Careers are assigned based on aptitude tests, marriages are arranged through sophisticated matching algorithms, and even leisure activities are carefully monitored, all justified as protection from the disease of love. This division isn't merely geographical, but ideological, representing fundamentally different views of human nature. The resistance believes emotions, even painful ones, are essential to humanity, viewing love as a source of strength rather than weakness. They argue that the capacity to feel deeply, even when it leads to suffering, is what gives life its meaning and beauty. Portland's leadership, conversely, maintains that emotions lead only to chaos and suffering, pointing to historical examples of wars and conflicts driven by passion. Through this contrast, Oliver poses a profound question. Is safety worth sacrificing what makes us human? Is a controlled, predictable life preferable to one filled with both joy and pain? The physical wall separating Portland from the Wilds becomes a powerful symbol of this ideological divide, stretching hundreds of feet high and topped with electric wire and surveillance equipment. As one character observes, the wall isn't just keeping us out, it's keeping them in. This insight reveals how control systems function not only through force, but by limiting people's ability to imagine alternatives to their current reality. The wall represents both physical containment and mental constraint, a barrier between not just two territories, but two ways of being human. At the heart of Requiem lies a complex love triangle between Lena, Alex, and Julian that transcends typical young adult romance tropes. Rather than serving merely as romantic tension, this triangle embodies the novel's central themes about love's complexity and the painful growth that comes with emotional freedom. When the novel begins, Lena is shocked by Alex's return. The boy she loved and believed dead has somehow survived. Yet he's profoundly changed by his imprisonment in the crypts, Portland's brutal detention center. His once warm demeanor has hardened into cold detachment. "I never loved you," he tells Lena cruelly, though readers sense this may be a protective lie. The Alex who returns is traumatized, bearing physical and emotional scars from torture endured because of his love for Lena. Julian, meanwhile, represents a different kind of love, one born in crisis rather than freedom. Having grown up as the son of the Deliria-Free America leader, Julian was raised to fear love before meeting Lena. Their relationship developed under extreme circumstances, creating a bond that's genuine but complicated by Julian's naivete about emotional freedom. What makes this triangle compelling is how it forces Lena to confront the complexities of love that Portland's leaders try to eliminate through the cure. She discovers that love isn't simple or controllable. It can be painful, confusing, and messy. When Julian and Alex physically fight over her, Lena doesn't feel flattered, but angry at being treated like a possession. "I'm not something to be won," she thinks, asserting her agency in a world that tries to deny it. The triangle reaches its emotional climax when Alex leaves a cryptic note referencing the story of Solomon, a biblical tale about two women claiming the same child. In the story, King Solomon proposes cutting the baby in half, and the true mother reveals herself by being willing to give up her claim rather than see the child harmed. Alex's note suggests he's removing himself from the equation out of love for Lena, allowing her happiness with Julian, even at the cost of his own. This selfless act demonstrates what Portland's leaders fail to understand. True love isn't always about possession or happiness. Sometimes it means sacrifice and pain. The triangle ultimately shows that emotional freedom doesn't guarantee comfort. It guarantees authenticity, with all its accompanying complications. One of the novel's most fascinating perspectives comes through Hannah, Lena's former best friend, who has undergone the cure and is now engaged to Portland's new mayor, Fred Hargrove. Through Hannah's chapters, we explore the unsettling reality that the cure doesn't work as perfectly as Portland's leaders claim. Before her procedure, Hannah was vibrant, rebellious, and fiercely loyal to Lena. After the cure, she becomes a shell of herself, observing her own beauty in the mirror but feeling nothing about it. "I am beautiful," she thinks, "but I no longer care." This detachment extends to all aspects of her life, including her impending marriage to Fred, which she approaches with clinical indifference rather than joy or even nervousness. Yet cracks appear in this facade of emotional neutrality. Hannah experiences nightmares about Lena, finds herself drawn to places from her past, and secretly helps Lena's family hiding in the Highlands. These inconsistencies suggest the cure hasn't completely eliminated her capacity for emotion, but has instead buried it beneath layers of chemical suppression. The novel's most shocking revelation comes when Hannah confesses to Lena that she was the one who betrayed Lena and Alex to the authorities years ago. This betrayal, born of jealousy when Hannah felt Lena pulling away from her for Alex, set in motion the events that separated the friends and nearly killed Alex. What makes this confession particularly chilling is Hannah's emotionalist delivery. "Before the procedure, I felt bad about it. Now, it's different." This moment crystallizes the horror of Portland's cure. It doesn't just remove the capacity for love, it eliminates moral conscience. Without emotional connection to others, ethical behavior becomes merely a calculation rather than an internal compass. Hannah can acknowledge her betrayal intellectually, but cannot feel remorse for it. Hannah's journey culminates in another betrayal when she chooses not to warn Fred about the bomb planted at their home. As she walks away from the house, knowing it will soon explode, she thinks, "I will not stay to watch it burn." This decision, neither fully emotional nor fully rational, suggests that, despite the cure, some primal instinct for self-preservation and justice remains. Through Hana, Oliver explores how emotional suppression doesn't create better people, but rather diminished ones, individuals who can recognize right and wrong intellectually, but lack the emotional capacity to care about the distinction. The Crips, Portland's detention center for those who resist the cure or show signs of the deliria, serve as the novel's most terrifying manifestation of institutional control. Through flashbacks and revelations, we learn how this facility embodies the government's willingness to destroy individuals to maintain social order. Alex's experience in the Crips reveals the systematic torture used to break resistors. He describes being kept in darkness, deprived of food and water, and subjected to psychological torment designed to eradicate his capacity for love. "They hurt you," he tells Lena, "and then they hurt you again, and they expect you to be grateful when they give you a moment to catch your breath." This methodical cruelty isn't random, but calculated to transform love into something associated with pain and fear. The novel's most disturbing crypt revelation comes through Hannah's discovery of Cassandra, Fred's previous wife. Imprisoned after Fred claimed she suffered acute delusions, Cassandra reveals the truth. Fred had her committed when she discovered his sociopathic tendencies and involvement in political assassination. Her imprisonment serves as a warning about how institutions can be weaponized against individuals who threaten power structures. What makes the crypts particularly insidious is their public acceptance. Portland citizens know the facility exists, but accept its necessity as part of maintaining their ordered society. This normalization of institutional cruelty echoes real-world historical examples where societies accepted detention centers and disappearances as necessary evils. The Crips also represent the ultimate contradiction in Portland's ideology. The city claims to have eliminated dangerous emotions through the cure, yet it maintains a massive facility dedicated to punishing emotional criminals. This contradiction suggests the leaders know their system is flawed, that human emotion cannot be fully controlled, only suppressed through fear and force. When resistors target the Crips during their final assault on Portland, the action is both strategic and symbolic. By destroying this instrument of oppression, they're not just freeing prisoners, but dismantling the physical manifestation of the government's control apparatus. While Requiem explores many relationships, its examination of family bonds provides some of its most poignant moments. These connections, particularly between Lena and her mother and Lena and her cousin Grace, demonstrate how familial love persists even when society attempts to sever it. The reunion between Lena and her mother represents a profound healing of old wounds. For years, Lena believed her mother had committed suicide rather than submit to the cure. The discovery that her mother actually escaped to the wilds and has been fighting with the resistance creates a complex emotional reckoning. Their initial reunion is awkward and tense, with Lena harboring resentment over her abandonment. When they finally speak honestly, Lena's mother explains she stayed away to protect Lena, revealing she survived years in the crypts by focusing on thoughts of her daughters. "I stayed alive for you," she tells Lena, highlighting how familial love provided strength to endure unimaginable suffering. This reconnection doesn't erase the pain of their separation, but offers a path toward healing through mutual understanding. Even more moving is Lena's determination to rescue her cousin Grace from the burning highlands. Grace, who was mute and traumatized when Lena left Portland, represents the innocent victims of the government's control. When Lena finds Grace hiding in a cellar as flames consume the house above, their reunion transcends words. Despite the immediate danger, Lena takes time to gain Grace's trust, showing extraordinary patience and compassion in a moment of crisis. The image of Lena carrying Grace through the burning house becomes a powerful symbol of familial responsibility. Unlike Portland's government, which abandons those it deems defective, Lena risks her life to save a vulnerable family member. This act demonstrates how genuine love, the very emotion Portland fears, motivates people toward protection rather than abandonment. These family reconnections challenge Portland's fundamental premise that emotional bonds lead to chaos and suffering. Instead, they show how such connections provide strength and purpose during the most difficult circumstances. When society breaks down during the resistance attack, it's these familial bonds that offer stability amid chaos, the exact opposite of what Portland's leaders predicted.
The resistance movement in Requiem isn't fighting merely for political power, but for something more fundamental: the right to experience the full spectrum of human emotion. This ideological foundation gives their struggle a depth that transcends typical revolutionary narratives. Unlike traditional rebellions focused on economic equality or political representation, this resistance fights for the very essence of human experience, the capacity to love, grieve, rejoice, and even suffer. What makes the resistance compelling is its remarkable diversity. It includes not only those who escaped before being cured, but also people who were imperfectly cured, sympathizers from within Portland, and even children who haven't yet undergone the procedure. Former government officials who've witnessed the system's corruption work alongside artists who refuse to let their creativity be stripped away. Parents who lost children to the cure fight beside teenagers who fled their procedures. This coalition demonstrates that the desire for emotional freedom crosses all social boundaries, uniting people who would otherwise have nothing in common. The resistance's methods evolve throughout the novel, showing sophisticated tactical development. They progress from simply surviving in the wild, living in makeshift camps and scavenging for supplies, to actively infiltrating Portland through complex networks of sympathizers and safe houses. Their final mounting of a direct assault on the wall represents not just military strategy, but psychological warfare, designed to show the population that the barrier between safe and wild is artificial. Each phase of their revolution requires different skills: survival expertise in the wilds, stealth and deception in infiltration, and raw courage in direct confrontation. Particularly moving is the moment when Lena realizes the final uprising includes not just invalids, but uncured children and even some cured citizens who recognize the system's flaws. A powerful scene shows a cured mother helping resistance fighters because she's noticed the emptiness in her own children's eyes. This diverse coalition suggests that the human desire for authentic experience cannot be permanently suppressed, even through chemical means. Even those who've undergone the cure retain some deep instinctual understanding that they've lost something essential. The resistance's focus on destroying physical symbols of control, particularly the wall and the crypts, demonstrates their understanding that oppression works through both physical barriers and psychological ones. The wall isn't just concrete and barbed wire. It's a manifestation of fear, separation, and controlled thinking. By targeting these structures, the resistance attacks both the practical and symbolic foundations of the regime. Their strategy includes not just physical destruction, but also spreading information about life beyond the wall through underground newspapers and secret meetings. The novel avoids portraying the resistance as flawless heroes. They make tactical errors, like underestimating government responses to their attacks. Internal conflicts arise between those who advocate for violent revolution and others who prefer peaceful subversion. Some members resort to torture or execution of captured officials, mirroring the government's brutality. These moral compromises create tension between their noble goals and questionable methods. Leaders debate whether using the government's tactics betrays their principles or represents necessary evil. This moral complexity raises questions about whether freedom can be achieved without becoming like one's oppressors, a dilemma that has faced real-world resistance movements throughout history, from the French Revolution to modern liberation struggles. The story of Solomon, referenced throughout the novel, provides a powerful metaphor for understanding true love. In the traditional biblical story, King Solomon determines which of two women is a child's true mother by proposing to cut the baby in half. The real mother reveals herself by being willing to give up her claim rather than see the child harmed. However, in the novel's version, the story takes a darker turn. The women agree to Solomon's proposal, and the baby is actually cut in half, leaving a bloodstain that can never be cleaned. This disturbing variation suggests that in a world without empathy, even the wisest judgment cannot prevent tragedy. When Alex leaves Lena a note referencing this story, he's acknowledging that his continued presence would only cause pain in her relationship with Julian. Like the true mother in Solomon's judgment, he's willing to sacrifice his own happiness for Lena's. This selfless act demonstrates what Portland's leaders fail to understand. Love isn't just about personal fulfillment, but often involves sacrifice and pain. Lena's mother later reveals the true story of Solomon, not about mothers agreeing to cut a baby in half, but about a king testing which mother would sacrifice her claim to keep the child safe. This version aligns with the biblical original and helps Lena understand Alex's actions. The contrast between these versions highlights how stories can be distorted to serve different purposes, just as Portland has distorted the narrative about love being a disease. The Solomon metaphor extends to the larger conflict between Portland and the Resistance. The city's leaders would rather cut the baby in half, destroying human emotional capacity, than risk the messiness of freedom. The Resistance, meanwhile, fights to preserve humanity intact, even with its flaws and pain. This metaphor reaches its culmination in the novel's final pages when Lena, standing with both Alex and Julian, acknowledges that things are more complicated than simple romantic resolution. Like Solomon's judgment, there is no perfect solution that avoids all pain. Freedom means accepting this complexity rather than seeking the false simplicity of emotional suppression. Through Fred Hargrove, Portland's new mayor and Hannah's fiancé, Requiem explores how authoritarian systems use the promise of safety to justify increasing control. Fred embodies the sociopathic tendencies that can thrive in systems valuing order above empathy. Initially appearing as merely a stern political figure, Fred's true nature emerges gradually through Hannah's observations. His casual cruelty, pinching her painfully during conversations, threatening her when she asks questions, reveals a man who uses violence as a tool of control, even in intimate relationships. Fred's most chilling moment comes when he announces Black Knight, his plan to cut power to suspected sympathizers on his wedding night. When Hannah questions what people will do for heat in Maine's harsh winters, Fred dismissively replies, "I guess they'll find out that freedom doesn't keep you warm." This statement reveals the fundamental bargain authoritarians offer: surrender your freedom in exchange for basic necessities. The novel's most disturbing revelation about Fred comes from his ex-wife Cassandra, who claims he tortured animals as a child and collaborated with invalids to plan the terrorist attacks that killed his own father, all to become mayor. Whether these allegations are entirely true or partially the result of Cassandra's imprisonment, they suggest that Fred's commitment is not to Portland's ideology, but to his own power. Fred represents how systems ostensibly designed to eliminate dangerous emotions often become vehicles for those with the least empathy to gain control. While claiming to protect citizens from the dangers of love, he demonstrates the far greater danger of its absence, the capacity to view others as mere objects to be manipulated or discarded. When Hannah chooses not to warn Fred about the bomb planted at their home, her decision reflects not just personal revenge, but a recognition that some systems are too corrupted to be reformed. Fred's manipulation of safety concerns to justify increasing control makes him the embodiment of Portland's fundamental lie, that emotional suppression leads to greater security rather than greater vulnerability to exploitation. The novel concludes with a powerful image of citizens, both invalids and Portlanders, tearing down the wall separating their worlds. This physical dismantling of barriers becomes the perfect metaphor for the book's central message about emotional freedom. As Lena observes people working together to dismantle the wall, she reflects that they can't know what lies beyond it. This uncertainty is precisely what Portland's system sought to eliminate through emotional control. By embracing the unknown, these people are rejecting the false security of predictability in favor of authentic experience.
The wall's destruction isn't portrayed as a simple happy ending, but as the beginning of a more complex journey. Lena acknowledges that freedom brings uncertainty and potential danger, yet argues this is preferable to the suffocating safety of control. "Take down the walls," she urges in the novel's final lines. "That's how you find your way out." This conclusion avoids simplistic resolution of the novel's conflicts. We don't learn whether Portland's government completely falls or if a new system replaces it. We don't discover which man, if any, Lena ultimately chooses. These unresolved elements reflect the novel's central insight. Freedom doesn't guarantee happiness or safety, only the possibility of authentic choice. The image of people working together to dismantle barriers suggests that freedom isn't achieved through individual escape, but through collective action. Unlike earlier in the series, when Lena's focus was on personal liberation, she now recognizes that true freedom requires dismantling the systems that oppress everyone. This final scene transforms the novel from a dystopian warning into a call for engagement with the walls, both physical and psychological, that divide our own world. By showing characters actively dismantling these barriers rather than simply escaping them, Requiem argues that freedom requires not just recognition of constraints, but the courage to tear them down, even when we can't predict what lies beyond.